left, they were still seen as threats to the establishment simply on the basis of their condemnation of the white supremacist nature of the state, of the treatment of Black people, of the suppression of Islam and variations of Black nationalism, which are and remain important to Black liberation. But there is a difference and a nuance here in terms of how the ADL and other elements of the state look to suppress various elements, on the other hand, of the Black community and its liberation movement.
Well, thanks for that. Let's just pause there for a moment. This report about how the Anti-Defamation League has been spying on Black activists in recent times.
From spying on Desmond Tutu for the South African apartheid regime to smearing Mark Lamont Hill and Ilhan Omar, the Anti-Defamation League sure does get around. In fact, it was found that the cagey organization had spied on at least 10,000 activists in 700 organizations across seven U.S. cities. At the same time it was spying on Desmond Tutu and selling the information to the apartheid regime, Israeli political figure Shimon Peres was attempting to arm minority white rule in South Africa with nuclear weapons. In 1968, the FBI began officially collaborating with the ADL, with the director of the government agency informing all branches to directly liaise with their regional leaders of the lobby group. This was, of course, simultaneous to the FBI's war against the Black community known as COINTELPRO. Was the ADL involved in this shabby conspiracy too? This level of cooperation between the FBI and the ADL did not stop an internal memo by the agency in 1969 from questioning if the ADL worked for Israel. The now declassified document reads, "It is felt incredible to assume the information is not furnished to an official of the government of Israel. It is believed it very possibly represents a violation of the Foreign Agents Registration Act. Despite that, today the ADL is the largest non-governmental trainer of law enforcement in the US and is closer to the FBI than ever." Which brings us to the question of a key asset in the Black community, the Reverend Al Sharpton. He has admitted spying on others for the FBI in the 1980s, describing his role as cooperating with an investigation by using electronic recording equipment in a briefcase to secretly record conversations with targets of interest. He's perhaps the ADL's strongest advocate in the African American community, regularly appearing alongside ADL leader Jonathan Greenblatt to support his statements. Less known about Al Sharpton is that for many years his show on MSNBC has been produced by Moshe Arenstein, a former intelligence officer in the Israeli military. The Black community in the United States is being targeted.
David, that's a really huge number of individuals and groups being spied on, isn't it? I mean, and all this was done with the connivance of the FBI.
The connivance of the FBI going back way back into the century, into the 1940s. There was an involvement there from the 1940s. The ADL tried itself to, first of all, to infiltrate the FBI, and that was rebuffed back in the 40s. But then they started to work very closely with them. And all the way through this period, they've worked closely with them. In the 60s, the files now show, there was some kind of questioning about what that, and we saw in the previous film, the whole question about the relationship with Israel, and the FBI said, well, of course, these people are giving this stuff to Mossad, but this is a bit dodgy, and it probably is against the law, but nevertheless, they continue to collaborate with them. It was only in the 1990s that the investigations first happened in San Francisco of some of the activities where these stats came out, the thousands of people, the hundreds of organizations which were spied upon. What's interesting about this is the way in which that relationship continues to this day. They advertise that they work together. And really what we should be seeing is a move away from the FBI and law enforcement working with the ADL, and more the ADL being monitored by the FBI, because they're clearly working on behalf of a hostile foreign government. And there seems to be no recognition of that in law enforcement circles in the US, but there is in civil society.
Mm. Well, Jared then explained how the ADL's influential position at both YouTube and PayPal in vetting content and access to these services actually affects those platforms?
Well, I don't think the ADL has, from my vantage point at least, I don't think the ADL has any more of an undue negative influence than the platforms already in their commercial organization have from the outset. What the ADL does is play its role within that broader apparatus of pro-imperialist, pro-Zionist, pro-capitalist, white supremacist workings to limit discussion and narrow discussion to what is considered sanctionable or acceptable to those politics. So they fit right in is sort of the point that I'm getting at. Without the ADL's involvement, there would still be plenty of white supremacist and pro-capitalist and imperialist narrowing of discussion, whether it's through the advertising arrangement, whether it's through outright surveillance and suppression of radical politics, or the like. So here, the ADL exists really to play the role among a certain class and ideology of Jews initially and Zionists more broadly to limit the discussion, even among the Jewish community, to make sure that radicalism doesn't go too far or get too much of a platform even among Jews. So that is clearly their tactic historically, and have used the anti-Semitic trope and the fear of the rise of a new black anti-Semitism for decades now to target, in this case, all forms of the black left, to make sure that whether it's on Twitter or historically in newspapers or magazines or elsewhere, that those politics remain equally narrow.
David, the ADL published a hair-raising paper back in 1992 entitled The Anti-Semitism of Black Demagogues and Extremists. I mean, who did they single out in that report?
Well, they didn't single out in the sense of a small number of people. They had a huge list of black politicians and indeed black cultural figures. So amongst the black cultural figures was Ice Cube, the rapper from N.W.A., and also, of course, the rap group Public Enemy were singled out in this. You can see it on the screen there. The notion of a black demagogue, extraordinary, really that they could have got away with that. And that's this is a file which is publicly available and has been disclosed through FBI. Freedom of Information documentation. So there's a real sense there which there, any of the key black cultural figures or black political figures were being targeted by the ADL in a way which is really quite, from this distance, clearly racist. But what's interesting about this document is that they say in there that they target extremists. And, of course, if there are Jewish extremists, we will target them as well. But this whole document comes about as a result of the famous Crown Heights riot, which happened as a result of a Chabad rabbi jumping a red light and smashing into two young black kids, one of whom died, and that set off the riots. Yeah. And there's no sense in any of this that Chabad, which as we know from previous programs, is itself an extremist organization. And there's never been an occasion when the ADL has ever denounced extremist Jewish organizations. And that's partly because it is itself an extremist organization. Mm.
Well, Jared also responded to the claims about the ADL being useful to the FBI as part of its clandestine counterintelligence program known as COINTELPRO, much of which was actually illegal. Jared described some of the background to this mysterious program and explained how the ADL could have been useful to it.
Illegal once upon a time, but post 9/11 in the United States, most of everything that was done under the counterintelligence program is now perfectly legal. Making the whole discussion of legality almost moot. But the reality is, again, as I've been just trying to say, the ADL is designed in its own origin in politics and focused as, again, a Zionist, imperialist, pro-capitalist, white supremacist, settler colonial organization. It fits right in with what the politics and the goals of the broader state itself. And certainly the FBI has no problem in promoting those politics and ideas, whether among Jews, Arabs, Black Americans, Christians, whomever else. And that's exactly what they've done and will continue to do. So if the ADL presents itself as being willing to be used, in effect, to take advantage of the actual suffering of Jews historically and in real time, to become part of a very conservative and anti-human apparatus, well, then they'll be put to that use. And to that extent, that's exactly what the ADL has and continues to do, and why they will more than likely continue to find a happy home in allegiance with the FBI and other, again, members of that apparatus, more broadly speaking.
David, tell us about Al Sharpton, who was mentioned in the film there. He's a favoured voice, isn't he, of the ADL?
Yes, but he hasn't always been. And in this document we were just talking about a minute ago, he was one of the key people who was targeted by the ADL as being a black demagogue, an anti-Semite, who'd led what they called a pogrom against the Jews in Crown Heights and the Crown Heights riots. And, of course, now he's not. Now, so what happened? Well, what happened was that his organization was penetrated. And we saw in the film there the relationship with his producer, who is former Israeli intelligence. But really what we're seeing is part of a more general process whereby the Zionist organizations try to penetrate anti-racist organizations to bring them on side so that they won't criticize Israel, they won't stand up for Palestinian rights. And if they'll do that, then anything is fine.
Mm. Well, finally, we asked Jared what he made of Sharpton's TV show actually being produced by a former agent of Israeli intelligence.
On some level, I think it matters for sure, and I think it's something that is not to be ignored or set aside. But I think it's on some level even unnecessary to make note of, given the politics of Sharpton and his show. And Sharpton has made clear for a long time that he has been part of the rebranding of black radicalism, excuse me, as something that is supportive of black capitalism, liberal to conservative politics, et cetera. In other words, the rebranding of the actual revolutionary politics of a real life Dr. King as something that would be acceptable to mainstream American news and media, which is, to me, all the evidence we would need of the kind of politics that he is there to represent and has been there to represent. The added fact or note that you mentioned about his producer is, again, interesting and I think adds important context, perhaps, but ultimately isn't that important given the observable, demonstrable, performative politics that Sharpton has been and continues to represent.
Well, I'm afraid we're out of time today. I hope you've found the program informative. Thanks to our guests, Professor Jared Ball, and of course our resident expert, Professor David Miller. And thank you for joining us today. We'll be back next week with more investigations and analysis on Palestine Declassified. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome to yet another episode of Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss your problems, questions that parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their children. The answers are based upon the Noble Quran and narrations from Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him and his purified family. Imam Ali al-Islam says, know the importance of your youth before you get old. and know the importance of your old age before you get ill. Now, how you can help your adolescents to know the importance of their youth? You got to educate them about the changes that are happening in their bodies. And to know more on the topic, today in our studio, we have with us our special guest, Professor Salman Nakavi, who is a faculty member of Al Mustafa University and a researcher in the House Almi of Qom. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome, sir.
Thank you very much.
Well, Professor Nakavi, we have been talking about the changes that take place in adolescence, and you said there are so many changes. There are biological changes, there are hormonal changes, there are physical changes, there are mental changes that take place in the life of an adolescent. But you as a parent should help the adolescent to educate about these changes. And also the important part with education is to help them in management of these changes. What else?
I would emphasize upon the importance for the development of the intellectual aspect of the child, so that he or she at that age, at the age of adolescence, because he or she is becoming a complete adult. Of course, we have two levels. One level is called bulugh in Arabic, the stage of puberty, where it becomes obligatory for a child to carry out these the responsibilities, not just the prayers and the ritualistic things. No, everything becomes necessary. All things which are wajib in Islam have to be observed. Or everything which is haram has to be refrained from. But there's a higher level that is called rushd.
Growth.
Rushd is a level where one's intellectual faculties become complete.
Okay.
He becomes a reasonable person. Therefore, in many countries, for example, the age for giving a driving license is 18.
Yeah.
Or even one is able to vote at the age of 18.
Yeah.
18 is considered to be a time where a person is now capable of making decisions on his own.
Independent decisions.
I mean, it's not necessarily 18. It could be before that, could be after that. Some children develop very quickly. They can become of that age at a very, even maybe at the time of puberty, if their development has taken place properly. But that rushd, and that is the way a person is capable to make his independent decisions. He can start a family life. He can manage his own way of earning his own living. He's expected to do things which he can become independent. In the West, in many countries, you see children at the age of 18, they start moving out of the parents' houses.
Yeah.
So that level, when one wants to achieve that level, of course, we should try to get to that level in regarding our children when they become 15 or whatever the age of puberty is. But it may extend beyond that. And in that period, the intellectual development is very important. Being able to make the right decisions is very important.
Yeah.
Therefore, this has to be worked upon, whether it is at school or whether it is at the home. They should complement each other. Intellectual development, awareness of our surroundings, awareness of one's own faculties, understanding what the world is about, going into the issues which are very, very complex maybe. And this understanding, I mean, for example, a person studies mathematics or philosophy or logic, things which engage, make his pure reasoning
very strong.
Very strong. Pure reasoning where one can depend on one's intellect and make decisions through pure reasoning. And after that, of course, application of that pure reasoning, both are important.
Yeah. We'll discuss more on that, Professor Nakavi, after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned with us.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. I'm Zainab with Professor Naqavi, and we're discussing about the changes in adolescence. Professor Naqavi, before going to the break, you said you would rather suggest parents in these all these changes to have most of their focus on the reasonable aspect of their child.
I mean, basically, the hadith says, Al-aql ma yu'badu bihi ar-Rahman. Intellect is the faculty that Allah Almighty has given to human beings. And through this faculty, human beings are able to be the...
reach proximity.
To achieve the proximity of Allah Almighty. They can become the servants, the true servants of Allah Almighty, obedient servants to Allah Almighty. So the important thing is, again, as I said, I reinforce what I said before, Islam does not want to enforce and impose any sort of belief on human beings. Actually, it wants to say that you have to understand what is the truth. قَدْ تَبَيَّنَ الرُّشْدُ مِنَ الْغَيِّ فَمَنْ يَكْفُرْ بِالطَّاغُوتِ وَيُؤْمِنْ بِاللَّهِ فَقَدْ اسْتَمْسَكَ بِالْعُرْوَةِ الْوُثْقَى. It's the way it says in the Ayatul Kursi, لَا إِكْرَاهَ فِي الدِّينِ. Deen, with regards to religion, nothing can be imposed. But the difference...
with logic.
Yes?
With logic.
The truth, the path of hidayah, of rushd, of growth and true development has become distinguished and separated from the path of deviance. And this قَدْ تَبَيَّنَ, and it has become clear through our thinking,
yeah,
and understanding. Therefore, to become, to Islam does not want to enforce anything, but it wants us to understand the truth, and that Allah Almighty is the absolute truth. So the intellect has to be developed in such a way that one really understands the whole concept of Tawheed, His absolute being, Allah being the absolute truth, and everything is under that. Everything comes, follows after that. My feelings, my actions have to be managed and controlled under the umbrella of that truth. So intellectual development plays a very important role. And this cannot be left for later years. It has to start before puberty, it has to continue, and it has to be enforced, especially at this in the age of adolescence. Studying subjects which give us that proper understanding is important about our beliefs, about our morals, about our principles, about our worldview. All of them have to be thought about, understood, and this is the age where it has to be done. Therefore, whether it is at home, whether it is at the school, high school, where children are now becoming prepared to go to higher studies, or if they don't go to higher studies, they want to go into the marketplace to,
yeah,
start earning, whether it is that or that. In both cases, a person, a salih person, a competent person, a person who is competent enough to carry out his duties, and we shall discuss about the four aspects which are there, which we,
yeah,
have been talking about. That is the groundwork that has to be
done before
dying at that age.
Yeah, we'll discuss more on that after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned with us.
The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam said, "Raise your children to have three features: love for your Prophet, love for his household, and reciting the Quran."
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. I am Zainab with Professor Naqavi, and we're discussing about the changes that take place at the age of adolescence. Well, Professor Naqavi, before going to the break, you said it's very, very important to give focus on the regional aspect, because through reasoning, one can reach the highest levels of proximity or achieve proximity, and one has to understand the truth. And basically, you as a parent, when you're teaching your adolescent before puberty, all those things, and you're developing his intellectual level by the age of adolescence to a level when where he understands the ultimate truth as Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and does not get overexcited with whatever he sees and is able to manage everything, you're basically helping the upcoming generations. You're basically guiding and upbringing them.
Exactly. So it means, it applies what a great deal of learning the parents have to do. I mean, if you want your children to learn properly and reach to higher levels of excellence and perfection, you need to be at a stage where you can take them along with you.
Yeah.
And if unfortunately the case is not so as it is in many households due to a lot of reasons, poverty is there, many things, social issues are there which impede the growth of society. And one of the reasons that we are not progressing properly as humanity as a whole, especially third world countries, Muslim countries, most of them lag behind in many things because the opportunities to grow are not there. The opportunities have to be provided. We can't enforce anything. We have to provide a conducive atmosphere, whether it is the state, whether it is the learning institute that a child goes to, the school, the college, whether it is at home. All of them should be focused upon, number one, intellectual development, number two, emotional development, number three, physical development, and based on this, ideological development, and the ethical and moral values that have to be inculcated and which then manifest themselves in the actions which are required of from a human being, a competent Muslim, and they then he has to or she has to manage the four relationships which are the basic elements of a pure life. The pure life that Allah wants us to live is under the umbrella of Tawheed, recognizing him to be the ultimate truth, and to manage all our affairs, all our actions, based on those pure intentions in life, with oneself, with Allah Almighty in the specific sense, ibadah, and then with other human beings, and then even with the environment. So this has to be developed. I believe that adolescence is the very important step in this development. That is the time where all our efforts, which started from the time that the child was came into this world, till the time now he or she wants to become an adult and an independent person. This final stage is the most important stage in the sense that that is the final thing that a parent can do. Beyond that, there's nothing which the parents can expect to do.
Yeah, so it's very, very important that you're saying that it is the final stage, not the beginning stage, because that's how it's misunderstood and that's how things become very, very difficult for parents with their adolescence. It's because they think that adolescence is the beginning age, while as per you, you're saying that it's not the beginning stage. It may be the final stage. Thank you so much, Professor Naqavi, for being with us. Thank you so much, dear listeners, for being with us. In case you want to listen to our programs, please go back to our official website, which is www.parstoday.com. You can go to the tab, Call of Islam, and find our programs out there. And in case you want to search us on the social media platforms, just type Call of Islam Radio. In case you have any questions, queries, or issues, you can feel free to share with us on our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir. With that, we end our today's session. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam is? says, it says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space returned upon rest.
Join us in this journey, IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
این چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا، ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
This is a part of political divine will of the founder of Islamic Republic of Iran, Imam Khomeini. The safeguard Islam itself is the most important obligations all great prophets from His Holiness Adam, peace be upon him, to His Holiness Muhammad, peace be upon him and his pure progeny, have strived and sacrificed for the protection of the concept of Islam. No deterrent ever stopped them from fulfilling this great obligation.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Welcome to a new episode of Spring of the Truth from IRIB English Radio. This is Zainab Mousavi, and in this program, we try to have a profound reading of Imam Khomeini's precious words and speeches. Well, about the subject of ethics and spirituality, Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi said that if mankind is self-constructed and perfected, everything will come out as spiritual. Even the materialistic will become spiritual. Well, Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi, through this sentence, is talking about the elevated level of human soul and its importance. Spirituality in Islam is the elevation of the human condition to a level where the mind is focused on the higher and non-materialistic realities of a godly existence. In the 79th verse of Surah Al-Imran, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala commands people to be rabbaniyin, or devoted servants to God. The message in this verse is to value spirituality more than worldly pleasure. What Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi is referring to is the very same issue. When one experiences the spiritual pleasure of doing good to himself or others, the pleasure is so much that it can never be compared to materialistic pleasure. Welcome back, dear audience. You're listening to Spring of the Truth. We're talking about the spirituality and its importance in human beings' life and level of elevation. Well, spirituality has three major elements in Islam, and they are purification, remembrance, and prayer. The first is purification of the soul. In that regard, the ninth verse of Surah Ash-Shams declares that, "And by the soul and what made it perfected and inspired its evilness and piety, surely the one who has purified it is successful, and surely the one who has corrupted it has failed." So we can see that purification means self-practice and self-building from Islamic point of view. Remembrance of God when one is up to an evil action or at any time is another element. Remembrance or dhikr can be performed at any time and any place. It can be done in many forms, either said by lips or just thoughts of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. This is why prayer or salat has to be performed at certain times and under certain conditions of piety. And by doing all the suggested recommendations of our holy book of Quran, the infallible imams and the great religious scholars, just like Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh, one can work on the spiritual aspects of him or herself and reach the real pleasure of servanthood.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Insight. Welcome to Insight. On this episode, we will be discussing the future of Brazil with Brazilian author and journalist Pepe Escobar. But first, this brief analysis.
The events surrounding the recent presidential elections in Brazil could have been taken from the plot of a political thriller novel or a movie. Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva emerged victorious in the second round of the elections, beating incumbent Jair Bolsonaro by a relatively small margin of 2 million votes in a nation of over 215 million people. He begins his third non-consecutive term as president of Latin America's largest nation, following years of judicial prosecution and incarceration on charges of corruption, charges which he eventually vacated by Brazil's highest court, allowing Lula da Silva to participate in the elections as the head of a multi-party coalition challenging right-wing incumbent Bolsonaro. These elections once again put on display the deep social and cultural divisions that exist in Brazil, rooted in its colonial history and the era of the U.S.-backed military dictatorship, which ruled the country from 1964 to 1985. Brazil is one of the founders of BRICS, accomplishing this with Russia, India, and China during the first period of Lula da Silva's presidency in the early 20th century as an important international organization challenging U.S. hegemony. Brazil is at a historic and strategic crossroads where it is, on the one hand, a key nation in the emerging new multipolar world, and on the other hand, the most important country in Latin America in which military and traditional economic elites have deep relations with U.S. security organizations who continue to wield influence in Brazil through these elites and who will do anything to prevent Brazil from being a fully sovereign nation outside of the U.S. orbit. The next 4 years of the Lula da Silva presidency will be interesting to see in terms of the level that Brazil is able to assert its full sovereignty in global affairs, contrary to U.S. pressures. And domestically, to what extent the economic situation regarding the tens of millions of people who live in poverty and the devastation left behind by the COVID pandemic can be alleviated.
Pepe Escobar, thank you so much for joining us on Insight.
You know, Salam, and thank you for having me.
My pleasure, our pleasure. You know, this is very good. We were really hoping to do a program on Brazil, particularly after the elections, and we were hoping to do it with you.
Thank you.
We always try to, when we're doing a subject, a country, we always try to find a person who's from that country to talk about the issues, because you know, it's a lot of the problems that exist in the media, in the global media today, is countries being talked about as opposed to the people from those own countries talking about themselves. And of course, since our program is Insight, you know, we always gain a deeper insight of the country when you speak to somebody who's really from that country and knows that country and has lived the history of that country. So we're very happy to have you on our program today. You wrote a very interesting article in Asia Times following the election of Lula, of President Lula, President-elect Lula, and the following elections. And in this, it was a short piece, but there was a lot of interesting little tidbits, a lot of interesting points, which, of course, you know, you didn't have the opportunity to get into them in the article. But I think it's a good place for us to start our conversation and see where we can go. And our goal is to really understand Brazil on a deeper level. This is always what we try to do in this program. You talked about, for example, that there are two Lulas. There's the domestic Lula and there's the international Lula. And you also talked about the historic context, or you made references, you didn't really get into it too deeply, about the historic context of what we're seeing happening in Brazil in the last maybe 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
And where I want to start with you is we need to go back in history, look at the fact that you talk about that Jair Bolsonaro, who was the president, who was the controversial president, as we know, in terms of a lot of the policies that he made, particularly as it related to COVID, but also his very enthusiastic support for Trump, his very enthusiastic support for Israel.
Mm-hmm.
You talk about not Bolsonaro as a person, but the Project Bolsonaro, which has been something that you talk about, the military in Brazil mm-hmm. having this project going on ever since you had Lula become the president in the early 21st century for the first time, a left-wing president becoming the president of Brazil for the first time since the early 60s, before the military coup. And I would just like to mention for our audience who don't know that there was a Brazil, the Brazil you grew up in, was the Brazil of a military dictatorship from 1964 mm-hmm. to 1985. So before we get into Lula and what's going to happen now and what the elections are, let's start with this idea that there is a Bolsonaro project, that there is maybe a deep state, maybe the power of the military is still very much real and alive, and their connections with the Americans and with the CIA, more than what we would think if we look at this kind of very cliche image of Brazil, you know, with soccer and Copacabana and everybody mm-hmm. having fun and being friendly. So if you could please get us started with giving us your insight about this part of Brazil.
Well, it's a wide-ranging question, and it's going to be very hard to put it in 5 minutes, but I'll try my best. This is a Hollywood trick. Explain the plot of the movie in 25 words.
Exactly.
So I'm going to use a few more to try to explain exactly. A very convoluted plot. Okay, we have to start in terms of modern Brazilian history. The most important fact is Brazil was a military dictatorship from 1964 to roughly 1985-86. That's a long, long time. It was one of the most sophisticated military dictatorships in the global south. Mm-hmm. It was not as bloody as in Argentina or in Chile because mm-hmm. it was much more sophisticated. Mm-hmm. And of course, there was a brainwashing of most of the Brazilian population because the military were selling the myth of the Brazilian miracle, which mm-hmm. happened to be economically a miracle, especially during the 70s when there was still low oil prices, etc. After the oil shock, of course, everything started to go down little by little. And in the 80s, they were completely lost and they knew that they couldn't stay in power anymore without any justification whatsoever. So they engineered a transition towards democracy, which, in the words of the military generals who were still ruling Brazil, was slow, gradual, and very secure. This is their own mantra for mm-hmm. this transition towards democracy. And, of course, the deal that they made essentially with the Brazilian politicians and ruling elites essentially is, okay, everything that happened these past 20 years, you don't touch it. This means you don't touch us. So that was the unspoken agreement between Brazilian elites, the politicians that they appointed, of course, mm-hmm. and the guys who would lead this transition, this this transition towards democracy. And of course, the military would be in the background, but monitoring the situation. In this interregnum, after the post-military dictatorship years, starting in the 80s, and especially in the 90s, we had, of course, when Brazilian inflation was exploding to a level that even people in Iran and all across the global south cannot even imagine, something mm-hmm. like 3,000% a mm-hmm. year, which is something absolutely unimaginable.
Right.
Something had to be done. That's when the Real plan mm-hmm. came up, which was basically a parity of the new Brazilian currency, which was called the Real at the time, and the US dollar, 1-to-1. And so it was a restart of the Brazilian economy. It worked at the time because the bankers who coordinated the plan and the president at the time, Fernando Henrique Cardoso, sociologist, mm-hmm. They were completely protected by Wall Street, the international financial system, and Washington. They considered Cardoso one of them. Cardoso had a very close relationship with Bill Clinton, for that matter. And all the bankers, they had studied in American universities, all of them, with no exception. You know. So it was easy. So it was a seamless transition. And at the time, that was the second part of the 90s, especially, Brazil was a sort of darling internationally because they were following the Washington consensus to the letter. And of course, in terms of the internal situation, not much had changed. Mm-hmm. But then Lula tried to become president at least 3 times. He lost 3 elections. Mm-hmm. But finally, in 2002, he was elected. But of course, to rule, he had to make a lot of concessions. To whom? The Washington consensus, Wall Street, international financial system, etc. But he had some margin of maneuver at the time. Don't forget that at the time, the empire was completely preoccupied or obsessed by its own designated war on terror, which was more like a war of terror, right?
Exactly.
And Lula, just to give an idea to all of you, Lula came to power 2 months before the invasion, the bombing and invasion of Iraq. Mm-hmm. Right. So his first years, he had more or less, he could do something in terms of social programs, eradication of poverty, sustainable development, bringing millions of people out from being excluded from the system to becoming at least lower middle class, if not middle class, you know.
Right.
So this happened during, especially the first and the beginning of the second Lula terms. Lula was in power from 2002 to 2010. We've been talking about what, 30 years. Brazil was a military dictatorship, was a failed economy, was a darling of the international system, and it became a model to the global south in terms of a sustainable development.
Right.
So these were four major different phases in a matter of only 40, 50 years, you know. So now, and that will bring us to what Lula is inheriting now, which is a completely different situation compared to when he first came to power in 2003, 20 years ago.
Okay, so it's very interesting, Pepe, you were saying that we had this period in the first period where Lula was ruling, where you had actually very real social development, poverty alleviation. You had jobs being created, basically things that you would expect in a very wealthy, rich country such as Brazil with all the resources that it has, a government who is not necessarily even very communist or Marxist or very radical.
Not at all. Yeah.
Right. You're saying that basically he was able to sort of get this coalition going where he had to have people maybe with him who are a little bit more, how should we say, center-right or center.
Yeah.
The result was that there was real change for a lot of the poor people in Brazil. It wasn't just, you know, something that was on paper. They really felt it. And then I want to go back to this idea that, like you said, the military is in the background. There's always somebody watching. There's always this point at some point where you can't really cross that line. And, you know, we see then the things that happened in terms of him being imprisoned and those issues, and also what happened with his successor, which was Dilma Rousseff, is if it was, for example, in a country like Turkey, you would call it a soft coup. You would call it as you know, in Turkey, they always have these. They have hard coups and they have soft coups.
Exactly.
Which, you know, when Erbakan became the prime minister following the Cold War in Turkey, he was Islamist. He came to Iran. And then, you know, immediately you had, letters being sent by the military and he was removed. So can we really say that what happened following the Lula era and then later with his successor, Dilma Rousseff, was in a way a kind of a soft coup?
No, it was a hardcore coup.
Okay, please go ahead.
Disguised as a soft coup.
Right.
And for many people, there was no coup at all. That's even more worrying because we could say almost half of Brazilian population, oh, there was never a coup. He was corrupt. He had to go to jail. Dilma was corrupt as well. And that's terrible because this is where we get to the massive fake news and disinformation campaign installing a cognitive dissonance among millions of Brazilians on everything that happened during the car wash corruption investigation, which was completely manipulated by, we can say, Brazilian fifth columnists, of course, but manipulated in the background by the Americans. Now we all know how it started, which was by the end of the Lula era. It started almost the minute Dilma Rousseff was elected as president in 2010. And the American campaign started in 2010 itself. And this is something that we later learned via WikiLeaks cables.
Please tell us more.
Exactly. WikiLeaks revealed, I think by 2015, years later, WikiLeaks revealed how the Americans started to spy on key institutional instances in Brasilia, Petrobras, everything tied to Petrobras, the Brazilian oil gas giant, one of the top energy companies in the world, and even the personal phone of President Dilma Rousseff.
Right.
All that is known, documented. Everybody knows it since WikiLeaks first revealed it. So this was a concerted campaign by CIA, FBI, State Department, Department of Justice, Treasury, etc., because they knew, now maybe we have a weak link over there. Lula is not in power anymore.
Right.
So first we go after Dilma, and then we go after Lula. For that, we need a lawfare mechanism.
Exactly.
And that's where the car wash investigation.
Right. Just to explain for our audience, lawfare is when they use the legal system to attack, to
attack, demonize, and eventually imprison and put in jail. Yeah.
It looks like a legal process that's very innocent.
It looks like a legal
process. But the reality is it's persecution in the worst case. In the worst sense.
Absolutely, with the bogus evidence or no evidence at all, with the co-option of mainstream media, which in Brazil was massive. The whole mainstream media was against Dilma, and then let's put Lula in jail. Everybody, especially the largest media conglomerate in Brazil, Globo, which owns Globo TV, which is probably the fourth largest, most powerful TV network on the planet after the three Americans, you know. Mm-hmm. So they have enormous power in the deep recesses of Brazil. Like, you know, they reach corners of the Amazon jungle that you don't even know they exist. But right. Everybody's tuned to the global newscast at 8 o'clock every night, you know, that kind of stuff. Right. So you have a corrupted Congress, corrupted judiciary, corrupted media, corrupted politicians, and in the background, of course, exercising plausible deniability always, the Americans. The whole American judicial lawfare system applied to the global South. And Brazil, for them, was a fabulous case because this was not a small African nation or a small nation in Southeast Asia. This was, at the time, a nation that was on the way to become the fifth largest economy in the world.
Right.
Which is what was happening during the Lula years and the beginning of the Dilma years, you know.
Right.
So, and of course, included in what the Americans always called our backyard. Because many of you probably know that the Monroe Doctrine, which is still going on since 1830, considers the whole of Latin America as the U.S. backyard. And Brazil is the top dog in Latin America. Everybody knows that, economically, mm-hmm. geopolitically, etc. Strategically, because it controls the South Atlantic, connections with Africa, you name it. So Brazil, you cannot afford, from the point of view of the American establishment and American elites and the American financial system, to have a Brazil that is relatively sovereign. I'm not talking about completely sovereign.
Right.
And that's what it was during Lula and in the beginning of the Dilma years as well. Okay, Dilma may have committed a lot of mistakes. That's another story. But the key story is that the engineering of a soft coup, as you mentioned, which was very well disguised because it was a hardcore institutional coup against Dilma, it worked so well that it took only 2 years to have her out. And that's where we come into the Bolsonaro phenomenon, because the Bolsonaro phenomenon started the minute Dilma was re-elected in 2014. This is essential to understand what happened afterwards and why we had Bolsonaro elected as president. 4 years after Dilma was re-elected, and 2 years after the coup against Dilma.
So please tell us a little bit more. So we have,
she's
basically following in the footsteps of Lula, and continuing their path. And then we see suddenly all these things happening, and she's gone. And then, you know, a few years later, we have this person, which, you know, we were joking before the program. You know, I said proto-fascist, but maybe we can just say fascist.
Yes.
Suddenly becoming the president, and we see a Brazil that's basically split in half, where you basically have 50-50 on both sides. So tell us what happened there.
I'm going to have to give you the short version, because it's an extremely convoluted process.
Right.
But, you know, the main lines, the guidelines of the whole thing is the success of using technicalities, mm-hmm. mostly, in Congress to basically impeach Dilma.
Right.
That happened in 2016.
Right.
At the time, the military and Brazilian elites linked to the international financial system and in a very clever way, posing as sovereignists, nationalists, but anti-system in their own worlds, but in fact, defending the macro system, which is the rules-based international